Hi, I'm the spooky force ghost of Ben Kenobi.
And I'm Baxamir von Flandernmeyer, of course, junior squire of the 17th platoon of the Monte Carlo's Elite Patisserie Committee.
And I'm... Oh no, Stefan told me to pretend to be attacked by zombies so he could retroactively edit this into the podcast. Help! I'm a fish, but also there are zombies.
Well, looks like Michael's been attacked by zombies.
And that's just what happens regularly on the podcast, Animating in Threes! Except for if Michael dies, it's gonna be twos.
Is he alright? Michael?
Ooh! Oh no, I'm a fish!
Okay, we are an animation podcast where three people talk about an animated film or series from an animator's perspective. And this week, we're going to be talking about that Rise of Skywalker trailer because I'm so into it. I can't wait for it. Actually, no, we're not going to be talking about that.
No, we're actually talking about the 2009 stop-motion animated film Coraline. But yeah, also as well, of course.
We can just talk about the CGI in the trailer because that's animation, technically.
Technically,
yeah.
I did.
Do you see all those things? Yeah.
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 Ain't that right, Michael? You're not here to tell me off. Oh, yeah, we should mention. So, Michael had to leave very early, so we ended up getting his opening thoughts for this podcast, but that's about it. And there's going to be some random clips of him during the show.
Ooh! It's like I'm still here.
But before we get into Coraline, the spookiest film for this Halloween episode. Michael?
Shut up, Ben.
We are going to be talking about some animation news from the past 2 weeks. So, Netflix is going to be producing a Bone Netflix series. And if you don't know what that means, because that sounds very vague, Bone is a comic made by Jeff Smith.
This is a character who was very, very popular when I was in primary school, but I never read any of his stuff.
Yeah, same.
It's always a thing, though, where whenever I would look at the covers, it'd be like this cute little character, it'd be him, and then there'd be like a horrific creature behind him.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why.
That sort of stuff too. I think I did read like one comic with him, but like, do you know how like when we were kids, we used to get like Mania magazine and K-Zone and all
yeah,
that?
Yeah, those things.
I think I read one of them in that once.
Okay.
But apart from that, yeah, I have no
familiarization
with the character, but I'm still looking forward to it because it is a very famous and popular comic that like it hasn't gotten an adaptation yet. So yeah.
Hmm.
There's going to be a 3D anime series coming to... All of these are Netflix related, by the way. Sorry if...
Netflix sponsor us.
Yeah. The director of Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood is creating a 3D anime series for Netflix. And it is about a little pod baby and her two robot parents. Yeah.
What the world?
So I'm showing it on Stefan's...
It's our classic segment. Ben shows us a thing on his mobile phone and you have no frame of reference.
But if you go on our Twitter page, you'll be able to see what I'm talking about because I retweeted it. And yeah, it's...
Anime 3D has various stages. It can either look really, really good or it can look kind of good but kind of soulless. Like
to me kind of looks a bit soulless, to be honest.
Yeah, this looks on the soulless side. I consider good CG like the Lupin the Third 3D that they're doing. Mm. This seems more on that soulless side where it's got the movement, it's got the action, but nothing feels like characters.
Yes, it's not characterized, nothing jumps out at you. It's just like, oh yeah, they do this movement, that's what they do. They don't do anything extending from that.
Which is a problem, because there's a lot of anime where they're trying to do 3D. Mm. Not going to mention the Berserk one, that's terrible. But there's some which are slightly better, but it's because it has that 3D that it just looks wrong. Mm. And like, it works well when you're doing Gundam and you have like a 3D robot, but otherwise... It kind of looks weird to see these 3D characters in a traditionally 2D medium.
Yeah, but however, the story could be excellent. We don't
know. Oh, very much so.
So, Netflix also released a whole bunch of other things that they're going to be doing anime-wise. So, there's going to be Levius, Seiki K, Reawakened, Japan Sinks 2020, Ghost in the Shell, Eden, which is the one we just talked about.
Yep.
It's called Eden. And more, only on Netflix. I kind of accidentally sponsored Netflix just then.
Yeah, accidentally sponsored. Very well.
Yeah, but what do you think about that? Especially Ghost in the Shell.
Ghost in the Shell is one of those franchises where they do anything and everything with. Like, if they wanted to do, they'd probably do a stop motion just because it's Ghost in the Shell. I don't think it really works for it. There have been stop motion, there have been 3D things done with it before, but a full-fledged one, I just don't know if it would work. I think its only saving grace would be because it's a sci-fi, that the 3D will just fit better in that genre.
Yeah, it really does look like video game graphics, like high-end anime video game graphics, but video game graphics nonetheless. Okay. And last of all, another Netflix thing, because that's what I follow
on
Twitter.
Because we totally don't like Netflix, yep.
There was a trailer for She-Ra Season 4 coming out soon in November, I believe. And it looks like more She-Ra.
Yep. Bunch of She-Ra.
She-Ra, She-Ra.
I don't even
I'm
know the theme song.
I'm up a song on my head.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Not allowed to sing on the podcast. Michael said so.
Ah. So, Stefan, today we're going to be talking about the film Coraline,
yes,
aren't we?
Yes, we're going to start off this spooky episode.
Ooh, Halloween.
Yeah, that, whatever. Let's go. Okay, so Coraline is a 2009 stop-motion animated fantasy horror based on the 2002 novel by Neil Gaiman, also called Coraline, which Ben has read.
Yes,
I did.
I
read a bit when I was in primary school. I just remember it being exactly, not exactly, but pretty much.
It is very
note
similar,
to note the
yes.
same as the film. So you're not missing out on too much if you haven't read the book. Although it would be nice to see just a Neil Gaiman book. They're always fun.
Mm.
So the film was written and directed by Henry Selick and made as Studio Leica's first feature film. It received critical acclaim, particularly for its dark, whimsical aesthetic and creepy yet wonder-filled narrative.
Are you saying that they thought it was spooky?
Actually, when was this film released? It probably wasn't even released during Halloween. It was probably released during April or something. It was nominated for Academy Award for Best Animated Picture and won various awards for Best Picture and Design from other festivals and ceremonies. The film took 4 years to make, with a total of 35 animators working on the film.
It was released in August.
Oh, okay. With, like, 500 other workers working on, like, fabrication
and
that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, because you need so many people working on a stop-motion production. You need not only animators and directors and producers, but you need people to make everything.
Yeah.
Make all the clothes, make all the sets, and even, like, set up all the special miniaturized lights and the tracks for the cameras and removable flooring and everything. There's so much work that goes into a stop
motion.
This
is one of those handcrafted films where every single thing you see has been made and handcrafted and exists.
Except probably that white world they go into the film.
Yeah, maybe that's just kind of a bit CGI.
But anyway, but yeah.
So we'll talk a bit about Leica. So Leica is an American stop motion animation studio, predominantly known for their feature film works such as Coraline, Paranorma, and Kubo and the Two Strings.
Say it again.
Paranorman.
It's Paranorman, yes.
Yeah, I said it wrong. I
said Paranorm. No, you went to say Paranormal, but kind of got the... Yeah. So ain't that right, Michael?
Ooh! Ferrari, I don't know.
He's still being eaten by zombies.
Yeah, that doesn't look fun at all, to be honest.
I think it does. Look, there's his cheek missing.
You're a sadist.
It's Halloween, I'm allowed to be.
So the company was founded in 2005 and was created as a successor to Will Vinton Studios due to the founders, Phil Knight and Travis Knight, seeking to expand the company and pursue feature film productions.
Ah, so Travis Knight, so he directed Kubo and the Two Strings and then also went to direct Bumblebee.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I just know that he started as an animator and his dad got him this company to work with, and that's how Leica was founded.
Yeah, so Travis Knight, he's also going to be doing the Uncharted film with Tom Holland.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, he's really moving up.
Yeah,
I'm
he's going
proud
good.
Of him.
Back to Leica. Henry Selick then joined temporarily as supervising director to front the production of Coraline. The success of the film allowed the company to pursue more features, as well as working on many commercials and other such productions, as well as working on Corpse's Bride.
Corpse Bride.
Corpse Bride. So while they were doing this, they were developing and exploring their unique techniques and aesthetic styles of stop motion, which we'll talk about a bit later.
Mm-hmm.
So about the director, Charles Henry Selick is an American stop motion director, best known for directing 1993's The Nightmare Before Christmas, James and the Giant Peach, and Coraline. Thing about this guy is...
He's pretty much done those three things.
He has, but everyone always looks at Nightmare Before Christmas and just immediately associated it with being Tim Burton's child.
Which is fair enough. He was the producer.
He was the producer and he did a lot of the character designs and design work. But Henry Selick is thumbprints and how he made the film is all over that.
Mm, definitely. Like, it's definitely a joint production baby thing.
Mm. But yeah, so the... It's good to give Henry Selick the credit he deserves for that film and this film. Because even Coraline has been mistaken for a Tim Burton film.
Yeah, many times.
In fact, that's probably why a lot of its popularity came when it was in theaters, because people thought, oh, it's another Tim Burton film.
Oh, this is when Tim Burton was at peak popularity. So.
Yeah, this is when anything he released was the bee's knees.
It was around when Melbourne had that Tim Burton exhibition as well.
That was awesome. I still have the tickets for that over there.
I think I do too. And I have, the Tim Burton art book.
So, he originally worked as an in-between animator for Disney, working on Pete's Dragon and The Fox and the Hound.
Ah, one of them is forgotten and remade, and one of them is well-loved and not remade.
No, please don't make a live-action Fox and the Hound.
Unless we are going to actually have a real fox and a real hound.
It'd be stupid.
And they're actually just playing with each other and they don't harm each
that's
other.
That's it. That's the whole movie, just looking at a fox chase a hound, and it's just got... And that's it. That's the entire film. 90 minutes.
Wow. Sounds spooky.
Oh, it totally does. It's really something.
Shut up, Stefan.
So, he claimed that he learned most of his skills about animation and storytelling during this time under the guidance of Disney legend Eric Larson. It was Henry Selick's smaller projects during his time freelancing, with such stop motion and experimental work such as Slow Bob in the Lower Dimensions and C-Page, which would lead him to working
Adam
with
Elliot.
Tim Burton on The Nightmare Before Christmas. In regards to Coraline, the author of the novel, Neil Gaiman, had just finished his book and met with Selick, expressing his praise for Nightmare Before Christmas, and from that, the two began exchanging ideas for making a feature-length adaptation of Coraline. It was Selick that suggested they add YB, because otherwise the story would be too short if they didn't have more characters.
Yes.
So that's why they invented new things to add to make it a feature-length.
But then again, the book itself could be straight adapted and be feature-length.
It probably could, but I think they just wanted to add...
But then again, the translation of book to film is obviously is very different. Because, it's going to be different because there's, thing that works in books, but it doesn't work well in live action or on screen.
For instance, in Coraline, if you were to have this girl constantly talking to herself...
Yeah, that just doesn't work.
It wouldn't be bad, but it would be a bit weird where she's just talking to herself. Whereas this, they have... YB, where she talks to this kid and you get
to know
more.
And it also adds a bit of that mythology with his grandmother as well.
Yeah. Mm. So, Henry Selick was the one who got Japanese illustrator Tadahiro Yusugi onto the project.
Yes, as Michael would say, the famous segment where we butcher the creators' names.
Yeah, there is
But that was actually quite good. Well done,
Stefan. Taking great inspiration from the artist's colour and character design work. He also did work on Big Hero 6.
Ah, cool. Also,
which explains why everyone has really cute dumpling heads. Yep, a bit about production of the film. With Coraline, Leica became the first company to do a feature-length stop-motion film using 3D-printed replacement faces.
Ah, so 3D printing. Can I talk about it a bit?
Yep, go ahead.
So 3D printing is pretty much you print a thing and it's 3D. So it's a bit more complicated than that. So you have this little nozzle. Say if you're icing a cake, do you know how you have that funnel nozzle thing?
Mm.
So it's pretty much like that, but very much a lot finer. And it prints a plastic or even you can probably do a metal or just various materials and it builds it up layer by layer. And eventually you have this solid piece of whatever you wanted to print.
But the thing is, usually for stop motion and with films such as Nightmare Before Christmas, replacement heads were made out of clay in kilns, that sort of thing.
So they had to hand make it.
Whereas this is the first film to actually utilize a computer-based drawing and then print it out into...
Yeah. So what they would do is they would create hundreds and hundreds of faces on, like, in a 3D program such as Maya or Blender or something, and then they would individually print them out. Except for, do you have how they split the faces in your notes?
No, each one was
separate. Yeah, so what they did with Coraline was, they would have the top half of the face, they would have lots of the top half, so that would incorporate the eyebrows and the eyelids and that sort of movement, whereas the bottom half would track the mouth and the cheeks.
Mm.
And then they would switch them out for whatever they needed, and then they would blend that seam together in post-production.
Many of the objects in the film are CAD drawings, as you said, which have been printed out, and it's a technique that has been pioneered by the company ever since. Like,
okay, so it is CAD, okay.
Yeah. They have used it a lot more exclusively in the... Like, they almost rely on it in their newer films.
So from Paranorman onwards, which is the film after Coraline, they use it so much and very extensively.
Whereas
as well.
I think Coraline has a good balance of what has been printed and what has been handcrafted. Like, the handcrafted stuff, you can tell is handcrafted.
I mean, we're not saying one is better than the other.
Oh, no way.
It's just that's how our stop motion has changed over the years.
So in total, there was 15,000 replacement faces, like parts, including the eyes 15, and whatnot.
Oh my god, that's so much.
In total, for created for all the characters, with Coraline having 6,000. Coraline had 6,000 alone.
So that's like 3,000 for the top, 3,000 for the bottom.
Yeah.
Oh.
There's so many. So each one having to be hand-painted from the initial print.
Okay, so something they wanted to do, which they could do in Paranorman, but not this because they were hand-painting, was they wanted to give characters more blushes and everything, and more, like, not just a one base colored face, but they found that with replacing all of the faces and everything being hand painted, they couldn't do that because otherwise the blushes would
look inconsistent.
Yeah, it would be very inconsistent and they wouldn't match up. So that's why all the characters don't have a lot of color to their face, and that's why they just have mainly just freckles or blushes where they wouldn't have to do the seam. And but in Paranorman, because they were 3D printing, they could more accurately get that right.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a little fun fact too.
So, it's stated that each Coraline puppet made for the film took about 3 to 4 months to construct, with 28 being used throughout. But they had about 4 main ones that they used, with the main one sitting at around 9 inches tall.
I'm guessing, like with 3D, you'd have to have specialized rigs for special types of movements.
Yeah. The film also required more than 70 character fabricators, modelers, painters, and wig fabricators.
Mm.
It was also the first feature stop motion to implement 3D into its theatrical release. And how they did that was they pretty much just filmed, when they did the stop motion taking the cameras, they did it with two different cameras at two different distances.
Yes.
And that's how they had to do it. Seems way too much work considering this film really doesn't need 3D.
It really does. And there's only one instance I can think of that used 3D.
At the very start. Yeah, the very start with the needle. Pokes through. That's it. It's just to remind you, oh yes, this is a 3D film.
Mm.
And then everything else is just like, forget about that. Here's a horrific spider lady. So we'll just go to the plot synopsis, then we'll go with opening thoughts.
Yep.
So the film follows Coraline Jones, an adventurous young girl who moves with her parents to the Pink Palace Apartments in Oregon. With her parents too busy with their garden catalogue to pay attention to her, Coraline is left bored and disillusioned with her neighbours and the house they've moved into. However, after receiving a doll that eerily resembles her and from one of her new neighbours, Coraline is soon lured into a portal which holds a mirror world, entranced by the colours, wonder and attention given to her by her other mother. Coraline becomes trapped in this now nightmarish realm. Her other mother, known as the Beldam, stops at nothing to get the young girl to have buttons sewn into her eyes so she may keep her soul forever. And so, Coraline and a dimension-jumping cat must play the Beldam's twisted games, rescue her parents, save the souls of the Beldam's victims, and escape her clutches once and for all.
Actually, that's one difference from the book that I remember. They used the word Beldam a lot more than the film.
Beldam just means old woman.
Well, they use it a lot more in the book, from what I remember.
Yeah, because Beldam has a very lore-like, yes, mythical-like sort of
connotations.
Connotation.
Stuff. Mm.
Anyhow, we'll go with opening thoughts. Michael just came back from the zombie, whatever he's doing.
Yeah, he's fine now.
He's missing like half of his mouth, but he should be fine. So, Michael, what were your opening thoughts on Coraline?
No, it was really interesting because initially I thought it was some kind of it was styled quite old. It was structured very old school, almost like a cautionary tale. It reminded me of like a Brothers Grimm kind of thing, when it was a kind of a thing about like your parents work quite hard for you to provide for you, so kind of I guess respect that they can't give you attention or something like that, which was kind of a weird message because the parents did seem genuinely neglectful occasionally. And I thought it was about like, you know, being appreciative of the family you have. But then it kind of turns into a battle with like an ethereal spider monster who lures children into her cosmic dimension by proclaiming her love for them. And I thought that was a very interesting turn of events that I didn't expect. But no, I think this kind of dark weirdness is kind of a dying breed in like the broader animation landscape. And I think we need more of them. Because at the moment, it's just broad appeal 3D animated films. Or like computer animated films. And we don't get very much hand-drawn animation anymore, if any. Like, you only see them in, like, short films. No, I thought this was really creative. It has a palpable atmosphere. It's, like, a really beautiful set design. Like, the point when, like, you can really tell their sets because they feel very insular. Like, nothing ever really feels truly outdoors. Everything feels, like, quite artificial. But that artifice is part of the charm.
Yes.
With a lot of these Leica productions. Like, you can really tell, like, where that kind of the seam... You can really see the seams and kind of where the set stops.
Actually, when you get more into, like,
Fantasy World?
That Kubo and the Two Strings, for example.
Yeah.
They use lot of CG in that.
Yeah.
That does actually feel open compared to this.
Yeah. Like, this feels quiet, but I like this more. Almost.
You gotta also remember, this is directed by Henry Selick, so this is...
What else has he done?
Nightmare Before Christmas.
Ah! Yes, I was gonna say, it looks... Well, I guess the aesthetic sensibilities are very similar. Even in Nightmare Before Christmas, a lot of it is very Tim Burton, like, with a lot of, like, his patterns.
Action.
Yeah, because I think there's not a lot of faith in, you know, children's ability to understand or accept darkness, especially kind of like striking like gothic imagery in children's media. And I like just the complete unapologetic devotion to that in this, which I think is really, really beautiful. It is really kind of like an old school Brothers Grimm fairy tale, when it, like, it's partially cautionary, but has like also elements of like eldritch horror. And like ethereal Lovecraftian concepts about creatures that prey on your emotions in order to suck like the life energy out of you. It's really heavy stuff for a kid's film, but it's really nice. And there is a lot of references to like America and a lot of states.
It is set in Oregon.
Yeah. Which I thought was like really nice.
Which is also where this company was founded.
Yeah. It reminds me of like, again, cliche, but like Stephen King works, which is the contrast between specifically American domesticity and theatrical cosmic horror, which is like a lot of his stuff, like a,
That's also a lot of Neil Gaiman stuff as well.
Yes. Also, yeah, we mentioned before this was... Yeah, characters are likable. They're kind of simple. But again, that's kind of how you do characterize your figures in Grimm-like fairy tales.
Mm.
They are relatively complex characters in and of themselves, but their purpose within the story is to relay this cautionary cosmic tale.
Mm.
But no, there's a lot of beauty in its production design and...
Like, a lot of love into it as well.
Yeah. And
like, you can tell this stuff is handmade.
There is this real beauty with that comes with like malleable, handcrafted animation. Like you don't get that. You don't really get that. It's really hard to get that with 3D animation.
It is super hard.
It's very... You can do it. It can be done. But usually when 3D does it, it's emulating 2D drawings.
Yes.
So it's hard to do that, and it's harder to characterize that well or that concisely in 3D animation. But 2D animation and stop motion, you have just complete... Like the art is almost an extension of the artist. It's a pouring of their personality and their work onto a page. It's really, really good. So yeah, I really like Coraline. If not for... Like, the story is like a... Again, you say it's structured a little bit strangely, because it does jump around a lot, and it doesn't end where you think it ends. It kind of ends...
And then,
when you watch it, it doesn't go where you think it's going. So in a way, that way, I suppose that's a positive because it's unpredictable and interesting in and of itself. But purely for the production design and the fact that we don't get enough of these types of films, and sadly, they don't seem to make very much money. Like Kubo and the Two Strings, I don't think made much money at the box office.
Well, I think it made it.
Yeah, so that was my very long, rambling opening thoughts because I have to leave and you have to retroactively edit this in. Thoughts on Coraline?
No, that was actually a really good... I actually really liked...
Yeah, everything that you said, Michael, was very good.
Going back to being eaten by zombies now.
Okay, Stefan, opening thoughts.
Opening thoughts. This is one of my favourite films ever. I love Coraline. I love her character. She's one of the strongest female leads in any film, in my opinion. I love the aesthetic. It's such a creepy yet innocent blend. As Michael said, it's got a great sense of keeping things dark yet keeping things still whimsical and fun. And it's a film that really a lot of kids should see. It's just a wonderful blend of everything that's great about animation and filmmaking. And I can't get enough of it. I think it's just spectacular. I could watch this over and over again.
Wow.
Okay, so my opening thoughts. Michael did touch on this because when we recorded his part, I mentioned that to get him on topic. But the act structure is very... It's not typical of a modern animated film at all. It is like four or five acts, which is very reminiscent of the book itself. And like what I was saying before about how like sometimes how books don't translate well to film. I thought they did like this four or five act structure compared to a three act structure really well, because it's like it kept you on your toes. You didn't know when it was going to end or what other twist was going to happen.
And it never seems too busy too.
No, it doesn't.
It still feels streamlined and as if there's only one story being told.
Mm. And let me say, all of the animation with Coraline and all the characters' animation is so superb. Especially, like, I really like Babinski's animation. His bombastic, eccentric animations. And also Coraline's hair. They do so much with it. Like, I'm so surprised how they could do it. Like, what is it made of? How could they do that with the hair? Is it, like, a really strong type of fiber that they have to move?
Yeah, it's basically like really tiny armatures.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's how they're able to move it. And they have to make each individual strand.
Because I know with Frankenweenie, which Michael has mentioned, I think. Did he mention it?
Yeah, I think he did mention it.
That they used human hair with that. So I don't think they were able to animate the hair as well as they did with this, which was made earlier. Yeah, but yeah, I found that, yeah, like really... very impressive. And also, a lot of the compositing in this, because you could tell that there were composited shots, but a lot of it was seamless. Some of it, there's only, I think, one or two instances where it wasn't that well composited, but most of it, really well done. All the character designs, and just how everything slowly morphs from this perfect, idyllic place, morphing into this really creepy...
nightmare.
Yeah. It's just spectacular. And there's a reason why this is still a very popular film. And for some reason, it spawned La La Loopsy Dolls with...
Yeah, what the hell was that? There was a stage where they had La La Loopsy. There was like these...
It was more like a ragdoll type thing.
A ragdoll. But they had buns in eyes. And every time I saw the commercial, it's like, why would you make this Coraline?
The weirdest ripoff ever.
Like, what makes you look at Coraline and think, I want my baby girl to have a boy, to have... button-dyed dolls. Because that makes me feel safe and responsible as a parent.
Actually, Stephanie had one. My little sister. She had one.
Why? They're so creepy.
She got it as a present, okay?
Okay.
But still. Yeah, those are my opening thoughts. So.
So, in terms of... we've already said the general plot. So, I think instead of going in order, we'll just go with animation things we like, because we all know everything in this film is handcrafted and is pretty much spectacular, so there's nothing we can really fault in that sense. Well, from my opinion anyhow.
Okay, I think some of the most impressive sorts of animation is like with a lot of stop motion, you have it like a lot of it from the waist up, so you don't have to animate the legs.
Yeah,
in this film they animate the legs in so much of it. Like, you see Coraline running and jumping, sliding across the floor. You have Babinski just jumping up everywhere.
It's always full body.
It's always full body. You have the two older women doing trapeze acts as well. And, like, all that is super impressive because a lot of the time, like, people don't want to go to the effort of having full body shots because they don't want to have to animate by hand every single thing.
Yeah,
but in this, they do.
They do not shy away from it. They're really bold with how they frame everything. And it's what makes the film seem really cinematic. Like, even though it's stop motion, and stop motion films are known for not being able to get as cinematic, like you've got your Wes Anderson films, which I love those films, but they're always flat. They're mainly very rigid with their movements. But this has an energy that makes it feel like 3D.
Are you talking about the stop motion, the Wes Anderson stop motion films?
Yes, yeah, okay. Wes Anderson, like Fantastic Mr. Fox.
And The Isle of Dogs.
Yeah. Like, they're great in their own right, but yes. If you were to compare it to Coraline, Coraline just embraces movement. Mm. Like, it has so much energy in all their actions, and it's so detailed. Like, the woman who, when she's, like, half-naked on the clamshell.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything is bobbling, and it looks so wrong, but it's so superb. But you can just see the animator's mind ticking as you've got the hair moving, you've got the bust, like, wobbling everywhere, and you look at it and go, it's an art piece, how every single thing is moving, and it looks so wrong, but it works so well. One of the hardest things in this film for them to animate, apparently, and you can actually tell, because it's the one point in the film when I think the animation goes a bit glitchy, like you can see the frame by frame, is when the jumping mice perform their little circus act.
I actually really like that.
It's beautiful. But they had to apparently do so many replacements for all the mice that it took them ages, and it was a chore.
It kind of reminded me of a zoetrope or zoetrope.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. You can see it frame by frame.
Mm. If you don't know what is Zoe or Zio?
I call it zoetrope.
But anyway, you can look it up. It will probably autocorrect you on Google. So what it is basically a spinning disc with a lot of characters on it, and it's like a lot of repeated characters. And what happens is when you spin it around fast enough with a strobing light, it looks like the characters are moving. And it's like pretty much a real-time stop-motion effect.
Yeah.
And that part was very reminiscent of that.
Even the fact that it actually was set in a circle composition.
Mm. Yeah.
But that was really impressive. Like, even how the mice's tails form Coraline's name.
Mm.
Like, I saw a little clip of how they animated that, and it was literally them, like, making the tails as they were going. Like, if they wanted to extend the tail, they'd add more clay, or they'd do this thing. It's like, that's incredible. But the tunnel that Coraline actually uses to get from one world to the other is actually quite big. It's like, imagine it like a giant, what do you call them? They're like an air duct thing.
Yeah,
it's made of like a fabric.
Yeah.
And it's so that when you have your character going through it, it has this squishiness because it's actually real.
Mm.
And what I love about it is they said that how they did like all these assets that seem very real in the film, it's usually just regular objects. Like for the flowers, how they pop up, they got a squishy dog ball, cut it in half, and when you pop it up, it looks like a flower popping up, and that's what they did. And it made me laugh because not only are these people amazing artists who can take anything and make it into something and have that eye, but they're also probably broke and just find whatever they can to get the job done.
Okay, my favorite animated part is the very beginning. So during the opening credits, we have this nice choral song that eventually gets some lyrics, but we have what you see from the other mother's perspective of making the Coraline doll.
Mm.
That is super impressive. You have these spindly, needle-like hands crafting this doll, and it's like done to perfection. It's all done with close-ups as well, and it's like, it's just so well animated, so smooth. And this is, I think, framed at 12 frames per second, all the film.
I would say so, yeah. Yes. Well, stop motion. Stop motion usually is 12 frames
per second. But it was so smooth and so well done. Like, and it didn't skimp out on any details whatsoever.
I also love that as a framing technique because you're from the eyes of the monster. And that is so haunting because all you hear is this really lovely children's choir. But then you see these horrific, needly hands making this really soft doll. It's like, what the hell is going on here? Mm. And it really brings you into that distorted world where it's like, this is going to be a cautionary tale.
Yes.
And it sets that up really easily.
It also sets up some sort of, not mystery, I would say, but some sort of like eeriness and tension to the world.
Oh, definitely. You want to know who's behind those needles.
Mm.
And talking about those needles, the other mother, I know in the book, the other mother originally, she looks like Coraline's mother, but is immediately longer and thinner than the mother. Mm. Whereas in the film, it's almost like a body horror transformation where,
I love
that. As it goes, she turns into this horrific
thing. Even just with subtle clothing choices that like change. Like in when she's wearing that checkered one and it has like that back top that looks like the thorax of a bug. I thought that was super clever. And, like, a really great foreshadowing of what's going to be happening.
And it feels like the horror movie The Fly, where she slowly gets more and more until at the end she's this
cracked
scarred,
porcelain.
But yeah, porcelain's a good word.
A porcelain, needly figure. And it's just so creepy. So there's a lot of body horror with it, and it's just amazing.
She looks creepy, but she looks fantastic. Mm. Like, can't... And even how they end up using her aesthetic in the environment around her, what ends up happening is, in the climax of the film, the floor breaks and turns into like a giant spider web.
I thought that was super clever.
And like, all you get is like the white of the voidless world with contrast with this metal spider web thing. And it just, the contrast, everything are beautiful. And in the meanwhile, you're contrasting it with Coraline, who's still in her like colourful vest and pajamas.
What's the scariest part for you rewatching it as an adult? Because for me, it would be when we... So, during the film where Coraline is in the other world, we have the fake Wybie with the buttons for eyes.
Yeah.
And then, like, the other mother keeps saying, oh, you need to smile more. And then eventually, like, she sews that smile on him. I thought that was super creepy and just like, oh my god, what are these characters behind... Like, that you suspect are just happy with these buttons. What are they actually going through? And to me, that was, like, really made me just reevaluate what was happening.
Yeah, you got to realize as well, even the other father, who's, like, the other mother's henchman, he doesn't want to hurt Coraline.
They're all the slaves of the other mother.
At the end, he even tries to give the button to Coraline, saying, take it.
Yeah.
And it's just, oh, it's horrific. What a wonderful kids' film. It's actually a brilliant kids' film.
It's honestly not that scary watching it as an adult.
No, it's not scary.
But for a very young kid, yes, it would be. But for like someone 10, 11 years old, it's a great film to show.
In terms of atmosphere, what scares me in terms of creepy atmosphere, when she's thrown into the mirror. Other side of the mirror looks horrible. It's just this dank, small room with just the little salt lights of the victims just stuck there.
I really like how they were animated, how they were very, like, staggered in how they moved and, like, how they blended that together with Coraline.
Yeah, it really felt like that they were lagging their frames. Mm. So you got a bit of the previous movement they did in their next movement.
And even when they come back as angels, it's still somewhat similar. It's more refined, but it is still somewhat similar to that as well.
They also have, like, a Van Gogh
Starry that was so weird. I noticed that as well. It's just when Coraline's dreaming... And then the kids appear in a dream. It's just the starry night sky in the background.
Oh. I don't know why. It was an odd choice. It works.
It does work. I guess it does lead into that dreamlike quality.
Mm. It's also the brightest part of the film.
Oh, definitely, yeah. No. I would say one of the brightest parts is when they're in the garden for the first time, the other world.
They said that was the hardest shot, hardest scene to do.
They're animating all the plants.
Everything is moving at different times. And it's like the dogs. Well, you got to realize, this isn't 3D where those dogs can be multiplied in the theater. Yes. They are little individual puppets, all little things that they had to wag their tails. Every single one of them.
I did like, though, how they cheated with the dogs and made them have no feet and just have matted fur.
Yeah.
That was a great cheat.
That's a good character design.
Yeah, it is.
In terms of aesthetic, one of my favorite room aesthetics in the film is when the other mother pretty much reveals herself to Coraline when Coraline tries to get through the door.
And everything's insecty.
Yeah, everything's insecty and she's just lying on the couch. The colour palette there looks brilliant. It's bright, but it's not that warming bright. It's a very sinister bright. Like,
neon type.
Yeah.
It's very... To me, it's reminiscent of Oogie Boogie's Lair.
I was just about to say that. Good. Yeah, good.
Mm. So it's that sort of sinister. Yeah. I was going to say...
I find it way creepier than Oogie Boogie, though. Oogie Boogie's like a giant huggable pillow.
I think Oogie Boogie's way creepier because he's made of bugs.
Yeah, he's made of bugs. But Oogie Boogie's having a great time. He just wants to torture Santa Claus.
And he wants to sing about it to everyone.
Yeah, and do it in a nice jazzy way, whereas the other mother does not sing.
Ah, speaking of singing, there is one musical number in this which I find very delightful.
Dad's song.
Yeah, so when we're introduced to the other father, in the real world, we have the father. He's very...
Michael mentioned this before he was eaten by zombies, where... He has, like, he looks so sad. Like, he has a giraffe neck
that's
hunched
over.
And he just looks miserable.
And he has bags under his eyes. And he's very grey. And But then in the other world, he's very lively. Instead of typing slowly on a computer, he's slowly playing some notes. And then these gloves come out and help him play this lovely,
bright, chirpy song on the piano about Coraline.
And the camera movements in that.
Yeah, it's a 360.
Yeah, there's like a 360. And there's like, it's a really great use of camera and like lively animation at the same time.
Mm.
And it, like, you might feel overstimulated, but I thought it was just the perfect amount of like, oh, introduce other amazing, fantastical.
Oh, no, I like that bit, Ben. That was really good. That was a realistic one to edit in. Which you gotta like put a really shit filter over the top.
And yeah, I thought that was really great. I think the best character designs in this is when in the other world, when she's doing the challenges and you have the two ladies in that candy wrapper and you have the candified versions of the two ladies when they're
scary,
younger.
Yeah.
That was amazing. Like, you're introduced to them being younger, but then you have them like twisted and deformed into this like candy toffee like construction. And it's super creepy, but really amazing.
That was one of the three challenges that was the creepiest of the challenges. Like,
yes,
the father one wasn't as bad. And
especially
the mouse,
because he didn't want to do it as
well. But the mouse one was just kind of fun because you had the mice firing cotton candy at her. I love how the story goes in this. Again, because usually in films you work with threes, with the three-act structure and whatnot. And also threes in terms of a certain thing. Like, I thought when I first watched this film, she would go into the world three times. And she does. But on the third time when she gets out and you think all's as well, you find out, oh, her
parents are gone.
And she has to go back in. And then you think, oh, this must be the end of the movie. No, there's a whole nother section where she needs to find these three things and save the souls. But it works so well.
And then even after that, you have one more ending where she has to chuck the key down the well.
And yet it never feels like a Lord of the Rings, oh, we have 20 billion endings.
No, it doesn't.
It feels like this is one story. It just hasn't finished yet because the Beldam is just so persistent.
Mm.
Now, I know from the book that she doesn't consume the kids as it's made out in the movie.
Look, I read it like 6 years ago, so I don't remember.
That's right. But apparently she just loves them and keeps them so close that she basically loves them to death.
Mm.
And that's what happens. In this, it's more it's made more like
she drains the life.
Yeah,
she
drains their life for her own.
Mm.
And apparently there's so many lore videos you can watch about Coraline that make it even more creepy. But overall, it's just a fun roller coaster of an adventure. It's great. Also, Coraline is one of the best characters ever. One of the best females, one of the best kid characters.
Actually, there's one thing that made me didn't like her.
Really?
At the start, when she called Wyborn, why were you born? I thought that was a bit mean.
I thought that was more playful in terms
of... It wasn't playful. She had a menace on her...
No, but more like a snarky playfulness. Like, why were you born kind of thing.
Yeah, but I didn't like that personally. But, like, I like her as a character.
He was kind of a stalker, though, in that first part.
Oh, let's talk about...
We didn't talk about the cat. The cat's great.
Oh, so he's voiced by Keith David. Keith David is such a great voice actor.
I know, he's
amazing.
He's
the president in Rick and Morty. Mm. He's the also reverse giraffe in Rick and Morty. He's in such a lot of stuff. And his, like, deep, rich timbre is just amazing to listen to.
But I also find it funny how usually when I see little characters, I hate when I hear a big booming voice from them because it doesn't make any sense.
But this one's more like a seductive type
voice. For the cat, it works so well. Like, you could look at that wise cat and realize that he's been here so many times in this situation. And it makes you think, yeah, that voice suits him. Mm. That charming yet kind of wise and mysterious voice that works.
Mm.
Also, I loved everything about his movement, how he looked like a cat whenever he would jump.
Yes.
And there were so many, like, I remember I saw, like, how they made him jump, and it's got all the armatures, which are basically, like, anything, like, wires they can do to keep the puppet up and edit them out later when they need to have the character jumping off a platform.
So, for example, Stefan has this Coraline figure on his desk right now, and it's being held up by this armor.
Plastic see-through thing.
Yeah, so they would have very thin metal ones for that, and that's how they do it.
Yeah.
But also, with Soul Motion, they also have pegs in their feet on the ground. They covered that up really well.
They did.
Unless if they didn't do it and just had the arm sticking out and edited that out. I think, like, all that cover-up was really well done.
In terms of this film's production, it's amazing how much better it is to The Nightmare Before Christmas in terms of how it's made. Like, Nightmare Before Christmas,
cult classic.
I love it. Yeah. Love it to pieces. But you can tell, like, as Ben said with the foot thing, you can tell there's things that are a bit rugged. It gives it a character, but you can tell there's things that don't quite flow as well. This film feels as streamlined as a 3D CGI, and yet has all the character and all the positives of a stop motion.
Okay, so the very end of the film, well, the very end climax of the film, we have Coraline trying to get the keys and chuck it down the well. I really like that as being the final ending, because it feels, to me, it feels more personal.
It also feels cyclical, because that's where she started. She started at the well.
It's a very cyclical story. You said it right. Well done,
I'm
Stefan.
I'm a genie. Yes.
Da 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 da.
But a big.
Michael's still being eaten by a zombie.
See, I thought that was, yeah, great cyclical story. You also have YB come back with his bike. I really like, actually, the shot where we first see YB with his bike and the helmet. That's such a great shot. And then when you eventually find out, it's just like this geeky little kid who's hunched over. I just think it's hilarious.
It is. It's really good. It also, plays with its horror atmosphere.
And going back to the end with the cyclical story of him being, like, stalkery and finding... Like, why was he out in the middle of the night?
No, the cat told him.
Oh, yeah, that's
right. That's why. The cat went to warn him, and that's...
Still, though. Anyway, I really enjoyed how, like, the hands was following her. Like, as you said, how persistent the other mother is into surviving.
Also, that area, without even trying, just that well area, looks creepy as anything with those trees with the cherry blossoms. Like, in any other circumstance, it would look beautiful. But for some reason, her isolated passing through those trees just looks... like horror movie material.
I was going to say, also having that like summoning circle around the well with the mushrooms.
Yeah.
Setting up the well as something important and some sort of like, yes, it's like a Chekhov gun thing where like, oh, this well is important at the beginning. It's going to come back.
And I also like how the well itself, when they throw the keys down, it looks like the portal to the other world, like was in Coraline's house. And it feels like, this well, even though it's just a normal well, feels part of this mythical lore. And that's the thing that this film really conveys. Instead of being like a hard-hitting sort of horror or action-adventure, it lingers on shots. It lingers on its horror, and it has this real atmosphere that it doesn't
just
shy away from.
Creating that tension.
It keeps... Like, one of my favourite scenes... I don't like the scene, actually. I hate it because it's sad. But one of my favourite scenes is where... Coraline is absolutely hopeless because she thinks her parents are gone. So she sets up the pillows in her parents' bedroom as to look like her parents.
Oh, that's
that
so
feels
sad.
So hopeless. But it's a really good, this is her low point. And then from there, she just becomes a badass and beats the beldam.
And she was able to do that because the old ladies had some care.
Yeah.
So as an adult, did you sympathize with the parents this time?
Yeah, definitely. Even as a kid, I sympathise with the parents.
So, because I haven't watched this in like 5-6 years, I definitely sympathise with the parents a lot more than I used to.
They're good parents.
They're just stuck in the middle of not only moving, but trying to get this publication out. Also, stop motion food. Let's talk about stop motion food.
Looks great in this again.
No. So, okay. So, whenever we talk about animated food, we usually always talk about how great it looks. But in this, they actually managed to make the disgusting food that Coraline doesn't like to look super disgusting.
Oh, the crap thing, the sauerkraut.
The chard and stuff. I don't know what it was, but it just looks so mushy and gloopy and slimy.
Also, when Coraline returns back to her world and there's the groceries that were old, they look old. They look rotten. It just looks disgusting.
And then compare all that to the food in the other world where it actually looked all... amazing. We had the roast chicken, you had that mango milkshake, you had the waffles, and that all looked like cooked to perfection. And I really loved that contrast.
It uses that duality of these two worlds and constantly makes the other world look amazing, but it also makes the other world look sinister in that it's always night. The colors, though bright, have this surreal darkness to it. Like, nothing's ever bright. It's always dull.
It's like a faux brightness.
Yeah, a faux brightness. As you said, neon. And also the fact that all the characters have black buttons in their eyes. Like, black buttons, you cannot make that look happy. Like, even when they...
Not even with La La Loopsy doll.
Not even with La La... Especially your sister with her La La Loopsy doll. It's not a happy doll. Not good. That thing better be in a closet. Like, you know how there's got Toy Story 4 and the dolls are being unloved? Those are the dolls that are being unloved. Because everyone will be like, no. No, they're not good.
Yeah.
They'll be like, I just want to be loved. It's like, no, you're not going to be loved. You're a creepy doll.
I'll agree with you there.
The father and mother apparently have a doll. What was that about?
I think it was just, so the mother was like, oh, Coraline's catching on that this isn't a great place. Let's quickly make a mother-father doll to spy on them to try to get them to capture them.
Is that how she would have captured them?
I would assume so, by spying on them with the dolls.
I guess that doesn't really matter. I like how they're trapped in the snow globe, but the thing about this film as opposed to the book, which I'm sure the book would have explained it, but why the snow globe were they trapped in?
That is,
it seems something that would have been significant, but it's like we're not getting that backstory. Like,
yes, we have the snow globe introduction at the very start when Coraline's exploring the house. Also, that's a great sequence. But anyway, but yeah, there isn't that much significance on the snow globe. Yeah, anyway, yeah, that is actually something that is weird. How the parents are trapped in
everything
the snow
globe. Walks you through it really well. All kids can pretty much understand what's going on. I think it just is a well-told story.
It is. Isn't that right, Michael? Oh, wait. Here's a puddle on the floor. Never mind.
Isn't that right, puddle on the floor? Classic puddle on the floor.
Okay, that's the end?
Well, we've said our closing thoughts. It's a brilliant film. You guys should watch it. If you don't like it, you're a jerk. Okay, let's move on.
Yeah, Stefan's being a jerk because it's Halloween.
Yeah, hopefully you like this spooky episode.
Okay, so that's the end of our talk on Coraline. So next week we're going to be talking about Michael's favorite film ever. No, it isn't.
Help, I'm a fish. I'm a fish.
Which is... it's actually a pretty alright film.
It's
you should go watch
good.
It. You probably haven't heard of it because it bombed at the box office. But it's good. You should watch it. Yeah, so if you want to contact us, give us suggestions, give us feedback, we are at animate3pod@gmail.com. And also, please, make sure you share this with friends if you liked it, because our views, they're getting somehow more dismal with every episode.
Hell yeah!
Anyway, we are anywhere you can find us on podcasts. And we are at Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. And that is all for now, I think. Star Wars! Wait, no, this is a Halloween episode. We have to talk about Halloween.
Ooh,
goodbye!
Spooky, scary.
The end. Hi, Stefan. Put this in random parts of the podcast to remind you you're doing a good job editing. Good job. This is a really hard job to edit. We're proud of you. And it's not easy. And we're thinking about you a lot, Stefan. Keep on trucking. Don't kill yourself. Help him a fish.